House Republicans announced on Tuesday that they are launching an impeachment inquiry against U.S. President Joe Biden.
Through our investigations, we have found that President Biden did lie to the American people about his own knowledge of his family's foreign business dealings.
Plus, officials in eastern Libya say at least 2,300 people were dead after two dams collapsed in the eastern coastal city of Derna.
Eyewitnesses say that two dams collapsed near the city, causing the deluge of water that inflicted the massive damage.
And Israel's Supreme Court is hearing the first challenge to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's contentious legal overhaul. Today is Wednesday, September 13th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good morning. I'm Rick Pantaleo in Washington. House Republicans are launching an impeachment inquiry against U.S. President Joe Biden. Details from VOA's chief national correspondent, Steve Herman, in Washington.
House Speaker Kevin McCarthy announced Tuesday that he is directing committees under Republican leadership to conduct impeachment inquiries against President Biden.
Through our investigations, we have found that President Biden did lie to the American people about his own knowledge of his family's foreign business dealings.
A focus of the investigations will be activities of the president's son, Hunter Biden, who engaged in transactions with foreign entities prior to his father's presidency. The House Speaker has been under intense pressure for weeks from arch-conservatives to move against the president. Democrats have released a memo detailing what they call Republican lawmakers' weaponization of their offices and exploitation of congressional power and resources to promote debunked and outlandish conspiracy theories about the president and his son. Steve Herman, VOA News, Washington.
Tulane University constitutional law professor Stephen Griffin spoke with Reuters on House Speaker Kevin McCarthy's announcement of an impeachment inquiry into Biden.
I've just never heard of a president being impeached because of the actions of a family member. I'm not aware of that's anything that's ever been proposed. And I think Republicans know this to an extent because they're trying to draw connections between what Hunter Biden has done, and certainly he looks like he's in a lot of legal trouble. But they have to establish a connection between Hunter Biden and some kind of near criminal connection. Each stage here involves risks for both parties. Republicans, if they don't come up with more than what they've got, they will face a real choice between pursuing things on the floor of the House when there will be substantial arguments and evidence against them, and maybe it would go down to defeat, and that would look very bad for them.
That was Tulane University's constitutional law professor Stephen Griffin speaking with Reuters news agency. Meanwhile, a new Reuters Ipsos poll shows Biden's public approval rating in the U.S. edged up this month to 42%, its highest level since March, bolstered by support from members of his Democratic Party, even as House Republicans launched their inquiry. For additional context of Speaker McCarthy's announcement, VOA's Steve Miller reached out to congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson to discuss the impeachment inquiry and what will happen next as the U.S. government faces a potential shutdown.
So, Catherine, we heard the announcement earlier. How did we get here? Because I recall it wasn't too long ago that Representative Lauren Boebert was calling for the impeachment of Joe Biden on the House floor.
That's right. So you may recall that U.S. lawmakers have come back from a five-week summer recess where they were not in Washington, D.C. They were back in their home districts. And while they were there, they were hearing from their constituents in some of the more conservative districts that wanted to see an impeachment of President Joe Biden. So the pressure was increasing on Speaker of the House Kevin McCarthy throughout the summer. He had said on several news organization media appearances that he was considering opening that inquiry. And by the time he got back to town this week, he was hearing from House conservatives that they were ready and prepared to shut down the government if he didn't give in to their demands to step up that inquiry into President Biden.
You mentioned the possible government shutdown. The fiscal year ends at the end of September. just, you know, really weeks away. Now that Speaker McCarthy has signaled that, you know, he's opening this inquiry into impeachment of U.S. President Joe Biden, does that change the needle on a possible government shutdown?
Well, the interesting thing about a government shutdown is that if the funding does run out, then that means that the U.S. Congress itself can only function in very basic ways. Committee work can't go on. An impeachment inquiry can't go on. So the very same House conservatives who are saying they want to shut down the government because their funding priorities are not being met are going to lose their chance at impeaching the president. So a really interesting interlocking set of issues that are going on Capitol Hill right now. And we're frankly running out of days in session in the year in 2023 to really get it all done. So it's a little bit of a train wreck right now.
One last question, Catherine. You know, taking a look at what House Republicans say they want to, you know, investigate the president for, has there been any evidence, you know, presented by the more conservative elements of the Republican Party in the House that shows potential wrongdoing by President Biden?
They have not yet directly linked the president to any wrongdoing. Now, the House Freedom Caucus has just wrapped up a press conference and is arguing that there is numerous circumstantial evidence that makes their case that President Biden has benefited and or used his office to benefit his son's foreign business dealings. Speak to Democrats on Capitol Hill, and of course you will hear that there is absolutely no evidence after months and months of investigation by multiple Republican-led House committees. They are noting that this doesn't come anywhere near to the level of high crimes and misdemeanors, which, as the Constitution sets out, must be the bar for impeaching a president of the United States.
Catherine Gibson is VOA's congressional correspondent. Catherine, as always, thank you for your time.
You're so welcome.
Officials in eastern Libya say at least 2,300 people were dead and several thousand others are missing after two dams collapsed near the eastern coastal city of Derna, sweeping away large chunks of the city and leaving outlying regions underwater. The dams collapsed under pressure from Storm Daniel, which wreaked havoc across eastern Libya on Sunday. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Torrents of water rushed through the streets and alleyways, causing buildings to collapse and sweeping away vehicles in the eastern Libyan coastal city of Darna. Eyewitnesses say that two dams collapsed near the city, causing the deluge of water that inflicted the massive damage following heavy rain from Storm Daniel, a strong cyclone which hit the area last week. Rescuers carried hundreds of people to safety in eastern Libya's largest city of Benghazi after water surrounded their homes and vehicles. Thousands of people were reportedly missing, and eastern Libya's interior minister told local media that one quarter of Darna was swept away by the flooding. Residents of Darna piled bodies in front of buildings and in makeshift morgues, lamenting the heavy death toll and the loss of many families in the flooding. Eyewitness reports say that corpses lined the streets in many parts of the city, and many others were carried away by the waters. Libyan media reported that the color of the sea along the coast of Darna had become a shade of brown from the muddy waters that flowed from the city into the Mediterranean Sea. A local doctor from Darna's rescue squad, Usama Ali, told Saudi owned Al Arabiya TV that many corpses had been taken to the city's Al Gubba hospital, but their rescue workers were trying to bury the dead as quickly as possible to avoid the spread of any diseases. He said that it was unlikely that many of those who were missing would be found alive. Colonel Ahmed al-Masmari, a spokesman for Eastern Libyan military commander General Khalifa Haftar, told Arab media that the collapse of the two old dams caused the torrential flooding. He says that floodwaters filled the mostly dry riverbeds surrounding Darna, sweeping away three bridges that divide the city into two parts and causing several dams to collapse from the pressure of the floodwaters. Interior Minister Issam Hossam Abu Zariba told Arab media that several European countries, as well as neighboring Egypt, had sent planes and rescue workers to help local officials try to cope with the flooding and heavy casualties. Eastern Libyan towns and cities from Benghazi to the Egyptian border spent much of the day Tuesday cleaning mud and rubble from many streets that remained impassable from debris carried away by floodwaters. Eastern military commander General Haftar, in a televised address late Monday, called on the country's central bank to release money to provide relief to those who had been hurt by the flooding and to help local officials carry out rescue work. Libya has two rival governments, one in the east of the country and the other in the capital, Tripoli, and political and economic decision-making is often paralyzed by the split. Edward Uranian, VOA News, Cairo.
Israel's Supreme Court is hearing the first challenge to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's contentious legal overhaul. Associated Press correspondent Mimi Montgomery reports.
As Israel's Supreme Court begins a hearing on petitions to strike down a law curbing its own powers, supporters and opponents of the government's judicial overhaul are taking to the streets. Those against it fear the plan will concentrate power in the hands of politicians and threaten a democratic system they're used to. Among them, this man protesting outside the Supreme Court.
I cannot see myself leaving a different social structure. And now I feel that Israeli democracy is in peril.
Proponents of the plan and Netanyahu's coalition of ultranationalist and religious lawmakers say the country's unelected judiciary wields too much power, as this right-wing supporter outside the Supreme Court explains.
We want to balance the system. We want that the government will have enough power to rule.
I'm Mimi Montgomery.
We're following these other stories from around the world. The United Nations human rights chief said on Tuesday that ethnically motivated attacks perpetrated by Sudan's paramilitary rapid support forces and allied militia have killed hundreds in the West Darfur region. Rescue teams in Europe are frustrated that Morocco did not open its doors to more outside assistance after last week's deadly earthquake. Morocco has taken a more limited approach than Turkey when it was hit by a devastating quake in February. For at least the second time this year, U.S. cyber forces have come to the aid of a Baltic ally as concerns linger about potential cyber attacks from Russia and other Western adversaries. U.S. Cyber Command Tuesday announced the completion of a two-month-long so-called defensive hunt operation in Lithuania alongside Lithuanian cyber teams. This is VOA News. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Rick Pantaleo. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un arrived in Russia on Tuesday for what the Kremlin said would be a comprehensive discussion with President Vladimir Putin. Reuters' Edward Barron has more.
In typical fashion, North Korean state media confirmed Tuesday that leader Kim Jong-un had in fact set off on a rare trip out of the country to visit Russia's Far East. His private train was headed to an unconfirmed destination for what the Kremlin described as comprehensive discussions with Vladimir Putin amid warnings from Washington they should not trade weapons. The Russian president gave little away to reporters who asked him why he was going to the Vostochny Cosmodrome on Tuesday, saying he had his own agenda there. US officials have said arms talks between Russia and North Korea are actively advancing and that Kim and Putin were likely to discuss the war in Ukraine. Weapons are one thing Pyongyang has at its disposal, but it and Moscow both deny North Korea could supply arms to Russia, which has expended vast stocks in more than 18 months of war. Kim could offer artillery rounds from North Korea's large stockpile, but questions about the ammunition's quality may limit the overall impact, military analysts said. Washington and its allies have expressed concern at recent signs of closer military cooperation between Russia and nuclear-armed North Korea. Kim's last trip out of the country was also to meet Putin in 2019. North Korea is one of the few countries to have openly supported Moscow over the Ukraine conflict, and Putin pledged just days ago to, quote, expand bilateral ties in all respects in a planned way by pooling efforts.
That was Reuters reporter Edward Barron. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan wants to repair relations with Syria's Bashar Assad, damaged by Erdogan's support of Syrian rebels for years. As Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul, Russia may be key to breaking the impasse.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan backed the Syrian rebels for more than a decade. Now, with the rebels facing defeat, Erdogan wants to repair relations with Syria's Bashar al-Assad, as the Turkish leader seeks to return millions of Syrian refugees. Analysts says it's become clear to Erdogan that Assad will remain in power, thanks to support from Iran and Russia. Turkish analyst Sinan Citi of the Washington-based Foundation for Defense of Democracies.
Now he has to coexist with him. I mean, coexisting means that essentially he has to negotiate with him because he has several asks of the Syrian regime. One is that there is massive public pressure inside of Turkey to essentially return a sizable number of Syrian refugees back to Syria.
But Assad is ruling out talks with Erdogan until Turkey withdraws its forces from Syria. For Erdogan, this is non-negotiable, saying it's vital for Turkey to counter the threat posed by Syrian Kurdish forces, which he accuses of having links to an insurgency inside Turkey. Former Turkish ambassador to Damascus, Ömer Onhon.
As long as Turkey feels that there is a security threat emanating from the southern part of the border or the northern part of Syria, Turkish forces will continue to stay there.
Assad was recently admitted to the Arab League, ending his regional isolation. Some analysts say that is emboldening him to take an increasingly assertive stance toward his powerful Turkish neighbour. Selin Narsi is a visiting fellow at the London School of Economics Contemporary Turkish Studies Department.
Bashar Assad, in his first speech at the Arab League, he mentioned about Ottoman Empire's expansionist policies. He complained about, he was pointing at Turkey. So the first thing he did was to criticize Turkey. So the bad blood will probably affect, continue to influence relations, despite the fact that Syria needs Turkey's support to rebuild its country.
Russia provides vital military support to Damascus, and Russian President Vladimir Putin could hold the key for Erdogan to resolve the impasse with Assad. At this month's meeting between the two leaders, Putin stressed the need for cooperation in Syria. Former Turkish ambassador to Damascus, Ömer Onhon.
It was Russia who encouraged, let's say, Turkey and the Assad regime to meet at the levels of ministers of defense and foreign affairs. So Russia has a role. But I mean, the thing is, does Russia's interests and priorities coincide with the interests and priorities of Turkey or even Assad regime for that matter?
Observers say the Syria conflict gives Putin significant leverage in his complex relations with Erdogan. Dorian Jones for VOA News, Istanbul.
The giant pandas that have been living at the Smithsonian's National Zoo in Washington for 23 years will return to China by the end of this year. VOA's Veronica Balderas Iglesias takes a look at the diplomatic moves that brought them to the United States and how politics and new conservation strategies could affect the species' future.
Xinxin and Linlin arrived in the United States in 1972, the rare gift from China was a sign of not only goodwill, but also soft power. After then, U.S. President Richard Nixon and First Lady Pat Nixon had paid a historic state visit to the East Asian country. Georgetown University adjunct professor Dennis Wilder specializes in U.S.-China relations.
It created very much an impression of China that was different from the harsh impressions of China that people had because of issues like human rights in Tibet or Xinjiang.
In 1984, when the giant panda was declared an endangered species, Beijing began lending bears instead of gifting them. 10-year agreements with a price tag of up to $10 million were put in place. Professor Wilder via Skype.
They decided that in order to help with panda conservation in China, that they would charge for the pandas. Zoos were willing to pay these kinds of prices because, as I again said, they are a major attraction.
Under one of those research and breeding agreements, which would later be extended several times, panda pair Mei Xiang and Tian Tian began living at the Smithsonian's National Zoo in Washington Biden in December 2000. They are not the only pandas who have made the U.S. their temporary home, explains Deborah Seligson, a former Environment, Science, Technology and Health counselor at the U.S. Embassy in Beijing.
We had a pair at the Atlanta Zoo. The Memphis and San Diego pandas have already gone back to China.
The Washington-based giant pandas and their cub are now also expected to depart to China by the end of this year. There's been some speculation that economic, political, and security tensions between the U.S. and China might be at play in the non-extension of the agreements. Analyst Dennis Wilder.
I do think that American scientists are quite willing to engage with Chinese scientists on many of these issues and want to keep it apolitical. But unfortunately, the Chinese system is one where it's very difficult to keep science apolitical.
Chinese authorities did not reply to VOA's repeated requests for comment. The success of breeding and other conservation efforts in U.S. zoos, however, should not be overlooked. Some analysts say the zoos have helped improve the species status from endangered to vulnerable. But others say it is time for a new strategy. Deborah Seligson via Skype.
I think the public understands more now than it did back then that zoos are not necessarily the way that you preserve animals in the wild. That's a different question, and you have to look at how you're protecting their feeding and breeding grounds and their ability to move and all these kinds of things.
The Smithsonian's National Zoo is planning to hold several events in Washington to bid farewell to its pandas. Zoo Atlanta has also announced its four giant pandas will return to China in 2024. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News, Washington.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. Until next time, this is Rick Pantaleo in Washington, wishing you good day, good health, and good news tomorrow.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In an effort to create the illusion of normalcy in the four Ukrainian territories it has tried to annex, Russia held local and regional elections there between August 31st and September 10th. The Kremlin hopes these sham elections will demonstrate its control over these occupied territories, but they are nothing more than a propaganda stunt, said United States Alternative Representative for Special Political Affairs at the United Nations, Robert Wood.
This is not a new tactic. These so-called elections in Russian-occupied territories of Ukraine are taking place nearly 1 year after the Kremlin staged sham referenda and purported to annex Ukraine's Kherson, Zaporizhia, Donetsk and Luhansk oblasts, and over 9 years after Russia purported efforts to annex Crimea.
Armed soldiers accompanied a number of canvassers who went door to door to get out the vote, and soldiers, quote unquote, guarded polling stations, intimidating voters. Many of the names on the ballots were familiar as Russian approved legislatures in the region were up for re-election, but a number of the candidates have only recently arrived from the far flung corners of Russia and were largely unfamiliar to the voters. Nonetheless, the effort was for naught, as the results of the elections were predetermined in Moscow. The Kremlin knows full well its elections in Ukraine are a complete fraud, but some within the Russian government are concerned about the perceived legitimacy and voter turnout for the elections in the occupied areas, said Ambassador Wood.
These sham elections in no way represent a legitimate expression of the will of the people of Ukraine, who have consistently resisted and bravely fought Russia's efforts to change Ukraine's borders by force for nearly 19 months. These Potemkin elections are an affront to the principles enshrined in the UN Charter. The Ukrainian people are fighting to expel Russia's forces from their territory.
President Vladimir Putin is sorely mistaken if he believes that holding elections in occupied territories and forcing the populace to vote for Russian-backed candidates will solidify his hold on these areas or gain international recognition of their attempted annexation by Russia. The United States will never recognize the Russian Federation's claim to any of Ukraine's sovereign territory, said Secretary of State Antony Blinken in a written statement. We remind any individuals who may support Russia's sham elections in Ukraine, including by acting as so-called international observers, that they may be subject to sanctions.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.